Welcome to Adaptation Today, a podcast for anyone interested in learning more about adaptation and how to study it. I am Gracie Bain, and today's episode was recorded by our very own Jim Fleury, one of the founding editors of Adaptation Today, and a voice that you've heard for several episodes. In this episode, Jim chats with Kyle Meikle and Liam Burke about franchise studies. The three chat about how franchise studies and adaptation studies are related, and some of the key scholarship in franchise studies. Finally, they tell us a little bit about what franchise studies looks like in the classroom. Without any further ado, here is Jim, Liam, and Kyle.
Well, thank you so much for being here. This is Adaptation Today with an episode titled Franchising and Adaptation. Let's get started by introducing ourselves. I am Jim Fleury. I am a senior lecturer of film and media studies at Washington University in St. Louis, and I specialize in franchising studies and video game studies. So I'd like to hear from the two of you, from my two esteemed guests here, about your name, your affiliation, and your research interests. So Liam, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm Liam Burke. I'm the discipline leader of cinema and screen studies at Swinburne University of Technology in Melbourne, Australia. And in terms of adaptation studies, my main research has been around comic books, comic book adaptations, and superhero movies. Although in recent years, I've been trying to move into what I'm calling everyday adaptations, which are vernacular, industrial, and unofficial forms of adaptation. So that might be anything from cosplay through to hyper-realistic cakes that look like everyday objects.
Fascinating. Thank you so much. And Kyle.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Great to be here with you and Liam. I'm Kyle Meikle. I am an associate professor of English and Communication at the University of Baltimore. And yeah, I'm broadly interested in adaptations and media franchising. No real specific media focus, although I guess my work more recently has turned back actually to literature from whence it started. So I can elaborate a little bit more about that later. But yeah, that's where I am right now.
Liam and Kyle, thank you so much for being here. So we're focusing today on the intersection of franchising and adaptation. So I wanted to get a sense from you two about what you consider to be a media franchise. So Kyle, why don't we start with you this time? What do you think how do you define what a media franchise is?
I think about this, Jim, in terms of sort of industrial configuration, right, that emerges in sort of its fullest form, middle of the 20th century, explodes really in the 21st. Mine is a probably broader definition, you know, more than most folks, that I also tend to think about the sort of loose franchising of unaffiliated texts like those written by Jane Austen, you know, that we can sort of think about Jane Austen perhaps as a franchise, even though she is not incorporated as such. So, you know, the kinds of franchises I talk about are both official, you know, sort of spearheaded by a studio or some kind of entity, and unofficial and unaffiliated, you know, and belonging to, I think, a little bit more what Liam's talking about in terms of everyday adaptation.
Thank you so much. And so when you talk about like unofficial and official, can you explain to the audience how you perceive that? Are you looking at it more from like a legalistic perspective, or how are you?
Yeah.
Parameters are you using?
Exactly. I think the further I've sort of drifted from adaptation towards franchising, and I guess we can talk about that distinction later on as well, the more I've become interested in issues like copyright, you know, in issues like marketing, and thinking about the way that texts announce themselves as firstly adaptations, but more pressingly as parts of larger media franchises. And that often needs to have some sort of, again, studio entity, right? Showrunner, creative guru, like Kevin Feige, obviously would be a great example here. Someone who is standing at the center of this gigantic and ever shifting and molding, you know, sea of text. Whereas when I'm thinking about Austen or Dickens or Shakespeare, there's no one studio that controls any of the rights to, you know, any of those authors. So those sort of configurations of texts, I think, are far more wily and in some cases far more interesting to kind of think about in franchised terms, even while franchising grows out of obviously kind of business practice.
Great. Yeah. So you're looking at it as like a textual cultural practice and not just as a industrial business legalistic practice.
Yeah, exactly.
Great. Liam, how about you? How would you define media franchises specifically?
I mean, I suppose in simplest terms, I think about it as this sort of attempts to market and media content under new conditions and new opportunities. And you know, when I think about how I kind of came to that, you know, franchising as a topic, it was because most of the adaptations I was looking at, which tended to be comic book adaptations, tend to be superhero movies, became kind of the, you know, the mothership of these very contemporary transmedia franchises. So that necessitated for me to have to think about franchising in a more distributed network sort of way, as opposed to the more linear or vertical relationship that we might associate with traditional page or stage to screen adaptation. And so, yeah, so that kind of made me kind of have to think about franchising and perhaps some of those distinctions between what is adaptation and what is franchising.
And that term mothership, do you see that term as like being specific to franchises, or do you see it also playing a role within adaptations too? Like in terms of like,
I mean, I think about it more in terms of franchising, in the sense that if adaptation tends to be a kind of a very kind of, you know, a vertical relationship, the best-selling book becomes the hopefully blockbuster movie, the successful Broadway show becomes a streaming service, you know, program, and so on. The mothership in you know, in that kind of very, you know, kind of Jenkins and others sense, is the driving platform. It is the thing that tends to furnish the core storyline, has the most amount of eyeballs on it. It's usually a film series, could be a prestige TV show, could sometimes be a game. I mean, it could be a variety of things if we think of less of the kind of the mainstream franchises. And then other pieces are sort of ancillaries or extensions. And, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about it, but sometimes the boundaries between what is the mothership and what are, you know, traditionally power decks or spin-offs or ancillaries has become a bit more diffuse as we get more balanced franchises. But I don't think of mothership in the same way I might think of, say, for instance, a source text, because the source text kind of necessitates some sort of repetition, even if it's just kind of the same character. Whereas a mothership, I think, is in that more traditional studio model of being a tentpole that kind of allows not just the movie studio, but some of the other subsidiaries of the large conglomerate to sort of benefit and succeed.
Yeah, and so to build off of that, we were getting now to this connection between adaptation and franchising. So what do you see as a relationship between adaptation and franchising, broadly speaking? We'll continue next after this to talking about adaptation studies in relation to franchising. But I just want to get a sense from you, where do you see adaptation fitting into the practice of media franchising?
I'll jump in just to say, I think one of the great affordances of studying franchises, why I've kind of turned towards them more full-throatedly in recent years, is I think they lay bare or make obvious some of the ways that adaptations are multiplistic, even if they don't seem multiplistic, right? I feel like there's so much more room to cover, and I may be putting the cart before the horse here, in adaptation studies to sort of convince folks, or at least there was for a long while, that any given text spirals in many different directions, you know, at any given time. Franchises wear that on their sleeve, obviously, right? In a way that not every adaptation necessarily does. So for me, that's what the relationship is that franchising is sort of adaptation practice made obvious or laid bare.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I always think of that Bazin quote about how mm-hmm. he wanted to get away from, I think he talked about the genealogical precedence of one material over another, you know, the idea that a adaptation is deemed derivative because it's secondary. And he said, oh, we need to think about it in terms of a prism, and each side is equal. And so Pride and Prejudice is not a book or a film, or, you know, in the case of something like Bridget Jones, a modern update, it's all of those and many more in between. And I think what when you hear studio heads talk about, you know, what they're going to do, you know, Donna Langley at Comcast, how they're going to make Universal Monsters work across multiple platforms, even though it's obviously economically driven and, you know, it can be a bit more, it's a very pragmatic implementation of this non-hierarchical relationship that Bazin was and others have been trying to guide us to in terms of our appreciation of adaptation.
And I wanted to get to this idea too now of like the relationship between franchising and media and adaptation studies. And I wanted to go back to a point Kyle was making about maybe this resistance early on, as you were saying, Kyle, about how it's not obvious maybe at first, right? Why franchising might be an appropriate fit for adaptation studies. So I'm wondering if you could speak on that a bit. So in other words, what do you think accounts for certain framings of franchising within adaptation studies?
That's a great question. I mean, I think part of it we'd have to think about historically, right? That adaptation studies is emerging in the middle of the 20th century, and it is emerging in a moment when film is trying to borrow literature's cachet, you know, in many ways, and sort of, you know, label itself as a legitimate discipline, which is interestingly precisely when this term franchising, as Derek Johnson has written about, really becomes sedimented in a way. I said, oh, I'm dating franchises back to the 50s. The reason I'm doing that and saying that and not going back to the 30s and like Abbott and Costello is because this is like the era of McDonaldization. And that's really where Derek Johnson is saying, no, this is where we've got to think about franchising as a concept cohering. So there's some kind of historical argument to be made here that I think, you know, the idea of incorporating franchising as a concept at that particular moment in time, late 50s, 60s, is probably not terribly appealing given what, you know, clout film is trying to borrow from literature. And then I think it's partly to the, you know, everything that adaptation scholars complain about under normal circumstances, strict adherence to literature as the sort of center of the field, you know, strict adherence to a very narrow set of literature, like within that remit, it's only sort of the canon itself. And then, of course, a rather strict adherence to the case study as the model for adaptation scholarship, right? And I think it takes decades to really shake off, cast aside those shackles and embrace intertextuality in a much fuller way. And again, you could trace that historically into why that's happening in the 80s. Interestingly, with sort of the rise of deconstruction, at the same time we see the rise of conglomeration, you know what I mean, to unite two very unlikely bedfellows, I think. But Liam, I don't know, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I would agree, co-sign everything you've said. I mean, I think of adaptation studies courses, units, modules, a lot of them might have been taught in literature departments, English departments, as sort of like the fun seminar. And when it's coming from that disciplinary background, the tendency is, as Kyle has pointed out, to do the case study, to do Shakespeare and Austen on screen, Dickens and so forth. And so the idea then, you know, given that that's already such a frivolous sort of endeavor to then, oh, and we're going to talk about Happy Meals and theme park rides, and we're going to talk about sequels, seem, you know, for some departments back then. And, you know, I remember the first adaptation studies course I ever taught was as an English department seminar, and they were like, you can do comics, but no more. Like that's far out as you can go beyond, you can do books, you can do plays, and we'll let you do a comic, but it needs to be a graphic novel. So you can do Ghost World, but you certainly can't do Spider-Man. And, mm-hmm. and that, you know, that's only 20 years ago, and it's not even 20 years ago. And so when adaptation is kind of came from that disciplinary background, I think there has been, not across the discipline, but there have been sort of, I suppose, reluctances or impediments to adopting a more broader view of what adaptation could be. And, you know, as Kyle has done through his research, as I'm trying to do through my research, and many, many others are trying to do, is trying to broaden our working definition of what an adaptation is and how adaptation studies methods can be applied. I mean, one of the probably, you know, one of my bugbears about adaptation studies is, you know, the tools of comparative analysis and all the taxonomies and stuff that have been developed over the past 20, 30, 40 years tend to stay within adaptation studies. And so, you know, I'll often see something in another discipline, a related discipline, media studies, film studies, game studies. And I'm like, oh, if only they had used, you know, Tom Leach here, or only they'd used Imelda Whelan here, or whoever. And you kind of go like, why don't they know that these concepts, these taxonomies, these terms exist? And it's because adaptation studies can, to a degree, can seem quite insular, preoccupied with mm-hmm. the page-to-screen process. And franchising is a way to say, oh no, these approaches are much more broadly applicable. And hopefully, you know, through focus on franchising and other efforts, you know, we can kind of convince mm-hmm. our colleagues in cognitive disciplines to come on board.
Yeah, the point you bring up, Liam, about broadening definitions of adaptations makes me think of efforts to broaden definitions of franchising as well, right? Like, yes, there is certainly like the term franchising going to like the mid-century, right? Mm-hmm. But even prior to that, there have been franchising practices evident, franchising strategies, right? With more literary forms, such as the Oz novels back in the first decades of the 20th century, right? And so it could be that maybe looking at these literary mm-hmm. precedents might be a way to to make franchising familiar to those who study adaptation, right? Especially from a literary perspective. So just any food for thought, just wanted to see if that's, do you end up, when you're talking about franchising your classes, do you look at these older literary precedents as well, like Oz, for instance?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm getting ready to teach a class on paratexts in about 45 minutes, and we will talk about Oz, we'll talk about L. Frank Baum, we'll talk about Edgar Rice Burroughs, we'll talk about, you know, Zorro and the Shadow and these early, you know, Shirley Temple dolls and things like that. And we'll talk about those early examples, because, you know, something you need to do with students, and perhaps we need to do with some of some researchers as well, is kind of to remind them that this is not as novel or new or as recent as they might think. And there was a value to thinking about how L. Frank Baum went about crafting the Oz series, attempts to create other book series that didn't quite work, and then sort of reincorporating them into Oz so that they would benefit from the halo effect of his more successful book series. And we see that all the time. You know, Transformers and G.I. Joe movies aren't that popular. Well, maybe if they're together, they'll be more popular. And, you know, authors were doing this 120, you know, years ago.
Yeah, thank you. And Kyle, how about you? Do you incorporate these older literary texts into your discussion of franchising?
Yeah, absolutely, Jimmy. I'm reminded, I hadn't thought about this in a long time, but like the first course I ever taught that touched on franchising was actually called The Afterlives of Characters. And that's essentially what we were talking about, was franchise characters. So Dracula, Tarzan, Sherlock Holmes, drawing a lot of inspiration, obviously, from Tom Leach's work in film adaptation and its discontents. And just thinking about the way that those characters, you know, were woven through not only film and television for much of the 20th century, but then eventually make their way into fan fictive forms. So a real touchstone for us on that course was Alan Moore's League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which, you know, unites a lot of those characters in Avengers-like fashion. So same as Liam saying, yeah, I always remind my students, nothing new under the sun, and certainly not when it comes to franchising, even while I really want them to be attendant to the way that Hollywood practice has shifted, you know what I mean, to sort of better articulate and encapsulate those multimodal and multimedia experiments.
Yeah, and I want to now consider, what are some of the courses where you have brought in adaptation studies to the study of franchises? And Kyle, we can start with you since you were just talking about one of your classes.
Yeah, so that was the course I just mentioned was one I taught as a grad student. The first course I ever taught at the University of Baltimore when I started there, I guess almost 10 years ago at this point, was Harry Potter and the Modern Media. They cut off franchise, but that is what the end of that course title was, where essentially we used Harry Potter as a way to talk about media franchising as a concept. And that was the first and only time I've asked students to read the entirety of Derek Johnson's Media Franchising with me. And it's because I was working on my book at the same time. So I thank them in that book, actually, profusely for sticking by my side through that process. But yeah, that was a course about media franchising in general. I teach within a design department. So I've taught courses on franchising and design specifically, so design practices within franchising. I have a grad student right now, Rick Pound, who's working specifically on this idea of design and character design specifically in franchises. He is a designer himself, and he hopefully will be joining me as a TA on a future installment of that course in next fall, a year from now. So yeah, I've taught it in a few different ways.
Great. And then Liam, you mentioned you're going to teach a class in a little bit. What are you teaching this fall, and what have you taught in the past with franchising?
Well, here in Australia, it's spring. So we're actually coming to the end of semester two and the end of our academic calendar. And so the unit I'm teaching right now is the awkwardly titled Screen Franchising and Innovation. And the way that works is the first half of the unit is 6 weeks of adaptation. So we think, you know, lots of the names we've already mentioned today, thinking about how something goes from page to stage to screen and vice versa. And then we have mid-semester break, we come back, we move in a more horizontal direction. So it's how, you know, intellectual property can be spun off in innumerable extensions. And so, you know, kind of students like that approach, and we kind of begin with the blockbuster. You know, so we're 1 year away from the 50th anniversary of Jaws, which most people would kind of identify as the sort of the first true blockbuster in the modern sense of the word. And it's kind of useful to let students kind of understand how that was a paradigm shift. The idea that you would have a film made because people wanted to see it, the need for spectacle, the need that it was on every screen at once. and the marketing that would have to go alongside that, and how it would become this kind of summer phenomena, and then become a tentpole for other, partners, other subsidiaries of the same conglomerate, and the synergistic strategies back then. And so this year we kind of focused on Warner Brothers, was kind of our way to walk through that direction, because Warner Brothers have their 100th anniversary, their fortunes are failing as a legacy media company, and you can kind of go from, Jack Warner through, the golden age of Hollywood through to New Hollywood, and then, Warner Brothers Seven Arts and all the different permutations up to today. And the idea being, by walking them through that journey, they kind of understand how business decisions, legislative changes, technological changes kind of motivate and influence and shape what the content is, and being attentive to the conglomerate structures, the business making decisions that give us our movies, our TV shows, and increasingly, the wide variety of content that falls under franchising.
And what assignments do you offer in either this class or others that you've taught that involve franchising? Because I know when this, for those listening, this whole panel came as a result of a panel that we did as part of the LFAAAS conference, where we were going over some assignments that we've used, right, to teach franchising in our courses. And I know, Liam, you had some really innovative assignments. And so I was wondering, can you speak to some of the assignments you've had students do in your classes involving franchising?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's two key blocks to that unit, and there's two key sets of assignments. In the adaptation block, students will adapt a source material of their choice to a five-page shooting script and redraft it each week based on the weekly topics and discussions and readings. This came about because I had marked enough essays where students said the filmmakers behind Harry Potter clearly didn't read the book because he didn't include this scene. I kind of wanted to put it to the students that if you think adaptation is so easy, you do it. And this kind of authentic assessment, this idea that it's kind of, real world focus and has a polished outcome, prompted them to be more attentive to things like your intended audience, context, changing social mores, budget limitations, and so on. And so each week, whether we're looking at taxonomies of adaptation or intertextuality in adaptation or context in adaptation, they think quite broadly. And we finish that block with a week I call Adaptation Everywhere All at Once. And we think about things like cosplay, AI, and other sort of non-traditional forms of adaptation. And they even use ChatGPT and other Gen AI things, that they put prompts into it based on their screenplay to see what comes back. So you get Bananas in Pajamas as a horror screenplay, and they compare that. And so that gives them quite a kind of a lively and intimate engagement with adaptation. And look, I'm not alone in doing this. I can think of Lawrence Roth, I think Tom Leach, many others have kind of either used this in the classroom or proposed this kind of practice-based approach to adaptation. And then the second half of the unit, which is the focus on franchising, borrowing heavily from Henry Jenkins, who's created a syllabus around developing transmedia franchises, students in groups will take an intellectual property that is untapped transmedia potential and try and design it as a transmedia franchise. They'll then pitch that in the final week of the unit in something like an academic poster session. So they have their posters, they're there in their groups, and a panel will go around and ask them questions. And they really get into it. So like, someone will dress up and bring food and music and stuff that's kind of teamed around their IP. Last year's winner was, because we have a student vote on the best one, was Pingu, which I don't know if that's a children's series that ever made it to North America, but it's kind of like a Swiss-German co-production. And they brought Pingu back, and it just made total sense from the themed food through to the online immersive experiences. It was really good. Another favorite was Papa's Pizzeria, which is a game that I wouldn't really know, but it's great when students bring those examples into the classroom. And everyone was kind of really responsive to that. And the benefit of that, again, of course, is just, it's practice-based, research, it's authentic assessment, it's knowing that a real person or people will see this, and it needs to be a popular, a polished, readily understood outcome. Kind of forces, I think, them to take it more seriously, to think about the key concepts and to kind of apply them in ways that aren't abstract, but are very kind of real-world focused.
Thank you so much. And Kyle, how about you? What are some assignments that you've found particular success with franchising?
really similar to Liam. I mean, I draw a lot of inspiration from Camilla Elliott's essay on doing adaptation, a wonderful piece about having her students essentially create anything their heart desires, ballets, cakes, Liam mentioned cakes already, traditional film, you know, et cetera, based on prior work. So in most of my adaptation and or franchising courses, students are going to engage in creative work at the end. Similar to Liam, I had my Harry Potter class at the very end, choose an IP, piece of IP, and then each group member was responsible for a different media adaptation, essentially. So one person might do a concert, another person was looking at doing a streaming series, another person was looking at doing a video game. And it was really interesting because they all had to collaborate essentially on a central guiding document, you know, that would inform all those different media tie-ins, but they were responsible for the individual tie-ins themselves. And similar to what Liam has done with his students, they pitched it to the rest of the class and, you know, we bought it or we didn't. Most of them we bought. They were really, really interesting ideas. My design students, you know, they can actually do a little bit more on the ground work because many of them are working designers. So they, for that course, actually designed tie-in products, you know, and or adaptations of their making. So I had students who did like growlers inspired by Harry Potter. I had a student do a card game. This was a really neat one, a paper card game that he prototyped based on the film adaptation of Battleship, that failed Battleship adaptation, if you all remember that. Surely I'm in a room where people, I know you two will remember that. So really interesting where they were thinking not just about kind of mechanics, but thinking really critically about branding, marketing, design, you know, in some pretty deliberate ways. And they would write a sort of essay reflecting on that. The only other assignment that I nudge my students to do, and this is more so in my traditionally oriented adaptation classes, is what I kind of call an industry practice essay, where they're looking at a broad range of texts, contemporary texts, to try to identify a sort of pattern in, again, marketing or optioning. You know, so if they're looking at televisual adaptations, they have to look at least 5 or 10 to sort of make some kind of assumption about adaptation and franchising practice today. You know, so what are the trends in streaming, optioning, and adaptation and franchising, or what are the trends in video game film making, you know, today? And that's very much inspired, again, by Camille Elliott, you know, Thai intertextuality, another wonderful essay of hers about the sort of different instantiations of Alice in Wonderland. And of course, by Simone Murray, a name that has not come up yet, but whose work was really crucial in helping me make my own pivot towards what she calls a sociology, you know, of adaptation and thinking about industrial practice alongside textual features and aesthetic concerns.
Yeah, and you both have brought up a number of really helpful texts and scholars for other adaptation scholars to draw from. I mean, I certainly have used a Henry Jenkins transmedia syllabus that he has publicly available to inform some of my own teaching on transmedia storytelling projects. And you're talking about like Camille Elliott's work as well. And so Kyle, I want to start with you on this one. What's some advice you would offer to an adaptation studies scholar who is going to be teaching about franchising, let's say for the first time? What are some particular case studies you might recommend? Are there particular texts that you think are quite user-friendly for a first-time educator dealing with franchising?
Well, I know you know this because I reviewed it, Jim, which is your wonderful edited collection, The Franchise Era. I'm blanking on the subtitle right now. Give us the subtitle.
Okay, so I'll plug my book here.
Please do.
Okay, yes. The Franchise Era, Managing Media in the Digital Economy.
Digital Economy. That's what I could not get to. So I think
I was the co-editor on that one with Brian Hartzman and Stephen Mamber, but yes.
Yeah. Your intro to that, I think, is absolutely fantastic in laying out the major questions kind of surrounding, you know, franchises today. So I've certainly used that. I've used Derek Johnson. I mentioned him before. A steeper climb for students, I think, especially undergrads, but the payoffs are very great if you can make your way through it. I've used Kristen Thompson's work sometimes on the Lord of the Rings franchise. It's pretty, you know, accessible and a good starting place. But I'd go back to, again, I think Camilla Elliott, especially if you were kind of moving from adaptation to franchising, I think Camilla Elliott's tie intertextuality or intertextually as incorporation in the tie-in merchandise to Disney's Alice in Wonderland is a great place to start, where she's thinking really specifically about adaptation theory's collisions with, she doesn't really put a name on it. She doesn't really call it franchise theory, but that is absolutely what she's talking about. And then, yeah, you all mentioned Jenkins already. You know, my hesitation around Jenkins, as you both, you know, may sort of share, is that at least in some instances, his definition of transmedia storytelling is quite strict. You know, it is something like the Matrix that is everything is of a piece and kind of moves in one fluid way from film to television to video game to comic book. So I kind of have to nudge my students past that particular conception, I think, of transmedia storytelling. But there's so much that's so good in his breakdown of the Matrix, you know, for instance, and elsewhere in Textual Poachers. I mean, there are lots of other places to pull from Jenkins, I think, really helpfully.
Yeah, and I do want to clarify that these terms that I think we've been all using, transmedia storytelling being the idea that you're carrying one story across multiple media platforms, with each entry within those platforms making a unique contribution to the overall story world. So like this would be the Star Wars films leading into the TV series, which lead into the comics and so forth. Whereas what we would consider adaptations typically are going to be strictly these multimedia franchises. So when Star Wars in 1977, A New Hope, was adapted into a Marvel comic book or adapted into a novelization. So these distinctions, yeah, but transmedia storytelling not being the same necessarily as, you know, multimedia franchising. So Liam, what about you, from your perspective, what advice do you have for adaptation scholars coming into franchising?
I want to agree initially with you, you know, the whole transmedia storytelling, because that not being the same as a transmedia franchise, because I think that can become a confusing for students to the point that they think the Happy Meal needs to have this sort of narrative weight and there's a clue in the Happy Meal that, and without that clue, I'm not going to be able to send a TV series. And it's like, your franchise can have storytelling elements, but don't limit yourself to that. So I think that's an important distinction that I think students sometimes kind of need to be reminded about. And so in terms of, you know, scholars I regularly cite, you know, this week, for instance, you know, we're going to make great use of Jonathan Gray's Show Sold Separately, which I think is a great book for taking paratexts seriously. I think there was this sort of eagerness to sort of import, you know, Genet's terms around paratextuality to media, where it didn't necessarily fit neatly. And I think Gray does a pretty good job, as do others, with sort of making that work and, you know, talking about hype and promos and things like that in a kind of a serious and sort of you know, very kind of methodological way. I'm also kind of, we talk a lot about audiences. The students do a lot of work on audience research. Matt Hills, historically, they really like Suzanne Scott's Fake Geek Girls. I think the introduction to that book is a great place to start when we think about, you know, some of those contemporary things around fan communities, gatekeeping, the potential exploitation of fan communities by those media industries. Scott coins that kind of great term, convergence culture industry, you know, bringing together Jenkins' sort of more perhaps utopic view of what was going to happen with the web, with kind of the Frankfurt School notion of how some of the old hierarchies, despite the supposedly utopic leveling potential of the web, were maintained and in some respects deepened, and how fans can be exploited to be co-authors in these texts, but really in many respects they are become this unlimited press corps, and a lot of their fan labor is sort of can sometimes be exploited. So I think Suzanne Scott is really sort of super precise in that. And we have to point out, of course, Kyle's book, if you're thinking of going adaptation, to think about franchising adaptation in the franchise era, is sort of essential to kind of map that sort of that journey as well. And in terms of kind of case studies, I mean, one of the things I found very early on was every second response from my student was Marvel. And I felt like what I needed to do was talk about Marvel early and then park it. So we do 1 week on Marvel as a sort of an exemplar of transmedia storytelling. And they go, not everything is Marvel. And then we kind of park it. And then so we would always fall back to those familiar examples. So even in terms of contemporary franchises, you know, we could use something like, you know, The Chosen, which is this very successful series, which is kind of trying to do what The Wire did, but for the Bible. And you have all these characters, and, you know, and it's distributed in very inventive ways. It has, you know, co-funding. It's distributed now on Amazon, but sometimes in cinemas. And, you know, so those kind of not just the action adventure genre to try and kind of move beyond that wherever possible. I mean, a case study I did this semester that didn't work very well was we did Wednesday and all the past Addams Family adaptations. And the reason I think it didn't work was it's very much a tween series. And so for my students, I think they're just 2 or 3 years too old for it. So I think if I bring it back out again in about 2 years' time when the current audience is in my classroom, I think they'll be much more receptive to it. But like, while they're aware of it, they're like, oh no, that's like a CW show and we've moved on we're a bit, you know, as 19, 20, 21 year olds. But I think the Wednesday example was kind of, you know, was interesting just going back through and how, you know, through the careful casting of someone like Christina Ricci in supporting roles, you know, through kind of aging up the characters. Just a really interesting example of kind of contemporary franchising.
Yeah, I really appreciate how you've both given examples of case studies, book, and texts that are helpful, not just to adaptation scholars, but to adaptation students. And I think it's just so important to keep that in mind, that student-centered approach to this teaching. So I just wanted to end with, if you had any recent publications or research projects you'd like to promote as we're closing up here. So Kyle, we can start with you. Do you have anything you want to plug?
Yeah, I have a book in process right now. Hopefully it will be out next year on the live action animated film. So it certainly touches on franchises, though not explicitly about them. So fingers crossed that that will see the light of day in 2025. And then the other book or big project I'm working on concerns HBO's The Leftovers. And to circle back to what I was saying a little earlier, Jim, literary franchises and sort of franchising standalone literature. So that has sort of spun off a couple of related projects, but thinking about the way that a lot of this franchise, and I talk about this a little bit in adaptations in the franchise era, of course, really still actually does come from books. So adaptation scholars in the traditional sense, you know, should be pretty happy. They don't have to stray too far from novels to start talking about franchises per se.
Great. Thank you. And then Liam, how about you? Anything you'd like to promote?
Yeah, I have an article coming up in JCMS that will have dropped by the time this podcast goes live. It's a co-authored article with two colleagues, Tara Lomax and Jessica Malinson-Teggy. And it's about screen tourism. And it looks at the experience economy. And it looks at how screen tourism is heavily scripted, drawing heavily on Norman Klein's work there. So we think of a scripted space. We might think of the idea of exiting through the gift shop. We might think of, you know, the architectural design of a casino that prompts you to want to stay and spend more. And then we're looking at examples like Northern Ireland with Game of Thrones, with New Zealand and Lord of the Rings and Tunisia and Star Wars, and how there have been attempts to kind of co-opt sort of grassroots fan tourism, fan pilgrimages, as Matt Hales would have it, and to commodify those and commercialize those. And that's true real world things like, you know, experiences, but also online as well through certain apps that direct you to kind of sites of strategic importance for local stakeholders. So, you know, certain restaurant, leisure sites and so on. So I think that's an interesting example of franchising as well. And I think the experience, you know, the franchise experience, whether it's pop-ups, whether it's secret cinema events, whether it's, you know, traditionally theme parks, live shows and things like that, it, you know, is a particularly fertile area. And so we're interested in seeing how there's an attempt to sort of minimize displacement so that when you go to Northern Ireland, it doesn't chafe what you imagine of the vaguely medieval aesthetic of Game of Thrones and how that can sometimes de-emphasize local specificity. So that I think is kind of will probably be relevant to the listeners of this podcast. And a major project I'm working on now is about Australian children's television. And that's another kind of, you know, it's a group project at Swinburne with colleagues at RMIT University. And we have a website called Australian Children's Television Cultures. And while we didn't talk about children's media much today, I think children's media, and I know Kyle would agree, is a kind of a really fertile and interesting space for adaptation and franchising scholars. And we're doing kind of a range of audience and industry-based research there. And that all goes up on that website. So, you know, I would direct listeners to that.
Well, thank you.
I would also, if I can, Jim, really quickly, got to direct listeners to Madeline Hunter's work as well, who has been doing some stellar research on specifically children's media and media franchising. So shout out to Madeline. Now and always.
Absolutely. I mean, actually going to say that the her piece on Lego, which I think was the adaptation award winner, is a course reader of ours. And we didn't talk so much about toys and stuff like that, but that's a really useful for piece if you want to talk about toys and merchandise and things like that.
All great examples to draw people to, and both of your projects just sound so fascinating. So thank you so much for this. And I just appreciate you being on the podcast today, and hope you all have a good rest of the semester and academic year.
This podcast is supported by the website Adaptation Today. To keep up with Adaptation Today, visit our website, adaptationtoday.com. Join our listserv where you can stay up to date on all the news in the field. Please make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast.